Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. As we've talked about a fair bit since November 3rd, and well, before that, for that matter, one of the most important aspects of this war for the free world, of course, is what happens to the United States of America. And what happens to the United States of America is determined in no small measure by what happens through its electoral processes. I am ecstatic to say that we have with us for a full hour a man who has devoted his life, really, to the law and to ensuring that it is enforced. And now in his capacity as a professor of business law at New Mexico School of Law, New Mexico State University, he has been thoroughly examining evidence that the last national election in 2020 was neither free nor fair. And we're going to explore with him in detail what he found through that examination and what it means. His name is Dr. David Clements. He is, as I said, former prosecutor in his native state of New Mexico. He was the deputy district attorney for 4 years and a prosecutor for 8 in Lincoln County, New Mexico. Prosecuted something on the order of 150 cases, as I understand it, and has brought that experience as well as his deep knowledge of the law to bear to help the rest of us understand the bizarre set of circumstances that we now confront with respect to specifically the presidential election of 2020. And we're going to talk with him about what he has found and why it matters so much. Dr. Clements, thank you for taking the time to visit with us at length for that purpose. It's great to have you with us at Secure Freedom Radio.
My pleasure, Frank.
Dr. Clements, I want to start with something that you said in a very impressive presentation that you made to a program that our friend Dean Michelle Bachman convened last month in Regent University's Robertson School of Government. It was an extraordinary program about election integrity and the lack thereof in the 2020 cycle. And you said something that really stuck with me, and that is that on the basis of what has happened here, we have to all consider ourselves jurors. We have to expose ourselves to the evidence as though we were actually going to make the determination as to innocence or guilt, the merits of the prosecution case and the defense's case and so on. Talk to us, if you would, sir, about why that's so, and then we'll get into what you have discovered in the course of your close examination and now serial public presentations of that evidence.
Yes. Well, Frank, I've done 120 to 160 trials before a jury. I stopped counting after a while, and I've prosecuted thousands of cases, and there's no magic to it. There's magic to the jury, but there's no magic to evidence. You take your case as you find it. You take it with the good, the bad, and but the best way to examine that evidence in the world is to present it in a court of law before a fair and impartial jury. And this is a jury of our peers. This is our common brother and sister here in the United States. And the reason why it's so precious and so miraculous is that you have the opportunity to have no conflicts of interest. It can be free of artifice. You don't have an expert or a lawyer doing your thinking for you, and you get to make up your own mind. And so one of the things that was shocking about this whole rollout of election law cases was that there were no evidentiary hearings. And that's understandable in one respect, because some of the charges were based in fraud. And fraud evokes larger due process concerns, where basically you're accusing someone of that fraudulent behavior. Well, if you do that, good luck trying to have your case wrapped up in less than a year. And anyone that's ever stood trial knows that it's a long and drawn out process. The problem here was that we had an election that we believe was stolen, and you've got to have some clarity within 2 months because the inauguration is January 20th. And so the fraud prosecution, if you will, didn't lend itself very well to getting a concrete ruling to ensure that you had the right person installed in the White House. And so you had a myriad of different challenges, but you had to raise the issue of fraud. So you basically had three different fronts. You had the fraud front that was valiantly fought by Sidney Powell and her attorneys. You had the Giuliani-Ellis faction that were bringing up voter irregularities. So we're looking at whether there's poll watchers, whether people were standing close enough, whether they had a meaningful opportunity to observe the ballots cast. And then you had probably the strongest legal argument, which was brought by Lynn Wood, where there was a violation of equal protection, where the standards for mail-in voting were so lax that you created a two-tiered system where you treated the mail-in vote differently than the in-person vote. Now, that one's not as controversial or sexy as the fraud case, but it was something that the Supreme Court could say, wow, that is a violation of equal protection. You've got to do your elections again. And that was the hope. One of those three methodologies to get in before the Supreme Court. Where I pushed back was on the media's narrative that there was no evidence. And they ran with a order from Judge Humatua in Arizona. And so I looked at that case, and I looked at whether there was a real evidentiary hearing. There wasn't. There was a motion to dismiss that lasted about an hour. And as I mentioned in that election integrity conference, Sidney Powell's lawsuit in that case was 400 and some pages. I think 300 of those were evidentiary exhibits. And there's just no way on earth that she could have presented that. And the other thing you have to keep in mind is when you present pleadings in a court of law, you're putting the judge on notice of what you have. There's far more, but it's what you can put in a piece of paper. And the idea is you alert them and you alert the other side if they want to challenge you to present their own experts and evidence and try to poke holes, maybe raise credibility issues, and that's completely fine. That hasn't happened in any county, in any state that I'm aware of. You've got some small change items that really weren't going to change the outcome. But when we're talking about outcome determinative lawsuits, not a one had an evidentiary hearing.
I need you to hold that thought because we have to take a short break. We're talking with Dr. David Clements about the 2020 election and that stunning fact that despite all of the evidence and all of the arguments, we have not seen a single judge ruling on the merits of the case in these various efforts to get election integrity restored. We'll talk more about all of that and what has happened to our election process as a result with Dr. David Clements right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to what I consider to be one of the most important programs we've ever done at Secure Freedom Radio, and that's saying something over the course of nearly 13 years. We're speaking with Dr. David Clements, who is a professor of business law at New Mexico State University. He is also a former prosecutor, having worked as the deputy district attorney in Lincoln County in Nevada, and he brings all of those credentials and skill sets to bear, fortunately for us, on one of the most vexing issues of our time, one of the most momentous, really, namely, what happened in the presidential election of 2020? Was the outcome what the voters intended or something else? And what are we going to do about it? Dr. Clements, again, thank you for this time. And I wanted to turn now to the nature of the evidence that you have studied so closely that we as jurors, as you put it, should also be evaluating and assessing for ourselves its merits. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the sheer magnitude of it and what you have done to assess it and the kinds of conclusions that you reached concerning the evidence of real electoral, I call it grand larceny.
Yes. Well, I guess I would start off with this, that the only requirement that someone needs in order to testify in a court of law is personal knowledge. If they're a layperson, these are fact witnesses. They're just reporting what they saw, what they heard. And across the country, we've got 5,000 sworn affidavits of people that saw and observed fraud. Now, in over 450 election fraud cases across the country, in Wayne County, for instance, there were 234 pages of affidavits in that county alone. And so some areas will have a far larger volume than others, but people saw fraud everywhere. Now, if we're looking at Rule 602, which is basically the rule of evidence that allows you to testify, every one of these people, whether you think they are good witnesses or not, are entitled and allowed under the rules to testify about what they saw. And then it's up to the jury to say, huh, we think this is credible, or we don't think this particular witness is credible, but they're allowed to testify. So that's the first point I would make with the audience. Here, what we've got is a flash mob conviction where the media has told us who won. They've told us who the experts are, and we're confronted with expert opinions on what to think. And that's not something that happens in the court of law. I mean, you have expert opinions for sure. They can make sense of the evidence, but you never remove the person with personal knowledge that observed firsthand. If this was the case, then, think about a murder case. Think about something that's less conspiratorial. People testified as to what they saw, what they experienced. The other thought was that you have many, many forensic experts out there that have either done statistical analysis, whether it's Dr. Shiva, whether it's Dr. Frank, who highlighted that there's an algorithm that's been shown to have been used in every county that he's seen. We've had forensic reports provided by the Allied Security Operations Group with Russell Ramblin. I've reviewed those. Every one of these individuals would meet the standard in a court of law, Rule 702. Their credentials are impeccable.
That's your professional judgment as a prosecutor who would evaluate witnesses and the cases made on the basis, at least in part, of their testimony before you decided to go forward with a case, especially in your role as the deputy DA.
Yeah, right? Well, there's no doubt that there's enough for probable cause to proceed on an indictment here if this is the construct that we're using. But my point is, once you're at the courthouse and you've got your witness list, every one of these individuals could satisfy the rules of evidence based on my review. And there's no pushback. I mean, you'd think that some law professor or some trial attorney would come back and say, Professor Clements, you're wrong. Not one person wants to die on that hill because they know I'm right.
Let me just ask you something, because what I heard you say a moment ago was that the mob rule sort of media response to all of this has been to sort of take selectively, obviously, evidence or witness testimony, or in the case of this Arizona judge by the name of
Judge Humatu.
In fact, is it not the case by and large that they didn't seem really to think there was any evidence at all to speak of with respect to the fraud? What we were endlessly told, this narrative, was that there's nothing to see here, folks. Nothing. Zero. Absolutely nothing, they often said. And that's what was so astonishing to me, especially against the backdrop of what you've described, that there was abundant evidence. How could they possibly have arrived at that narrative, which seems so patently false?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, right? It depends on the ability of your audience to comprehend a thing called evil. It's good. And this is a good versus evil battle. This isn't, I don't deal in conspiracies. This is basically, you tell me why these witnesses couldn't have a day in court. And the answer is, there is no reason why. So it begs the next question. Why are certain gatekeepers not allowing them to have access to the court? Why was it as soon as there was an objection from Arizona on January 6th to hear evidence of fraud over the dueling electors that the riot just happened to start just then and every single Republican turned tail? I mean, I've got suspicions, but the facts are the facts. That happened. And as soon as that happened, no one wanted to talk about fraud. So there's a lot of...
And that's where the evil kicks in, I guess. Just one quick point on this. You have described that there was a sort of groupthink quality to this, that people shut down. One of the pregnant questions that you posed in this program, and I want to commend to our listeners where you can find this 7-hour program on election integrity at Regent University. It is at regent.edu/election integrity. And you can find there the video of Dr. Clement's presentation at the end, the closing arguments, I think is how Michelle Bachmann put it, but a whole host of other remarkable and very powerful presentations by others, from Dr. Ben Carson to the Hoff brothers of Gateway Pundit and so many others, experts in the field, as well as people who have been commenting on it, Eric Metaxas, for example. But, Doctor, you asked, where was the FBI? And what's the answer to that question? They have a responsibility to collect and evaluate this kind of evidence of fraudulent activity, violation of federal law, do they not? And how is it that they seem to be so absent from all of this?
Yeah, well, that's the sad part of this. There were reports out of Georgia, for instance, where there were observations of ballots being shredded in Georgia, and people have seen the pictures of shredded ballots. And there were honest poll workers that brought this the attention to the FBI. The FBI came and basically dismissed the Republican poll watchers or the poll workers that observed this, dismissed them, and then guess what happened? The ballot shredding resumed. Now, that's one example. I don't have examples from every county, but when you have someone like William Barr make strong statements that, to his knowledge, he wasn't aware of any evidence suggesting massive election fraud. There are other examples in Pennsylvania where the FBI were alerted and they did nothing. And so the questions that are raised is the way that I try to describe this to people. Is I've worked in a border region where I was the lead HIDTA drug trafficking enforcement attorney for some time. But I lived in a district, or I worked in a district, where the mayor of the city was put in prison for corruption, that the police chief was put in prison for corruption. So it's not beyond my comprehension to understand that there is a power struggle going on within the FBI. There is a power struggle going on within the DOJ. I know many FBI agents that are good, good men, but even they have told me that there are certain gatekeepers positions, a vestige or the remains of the Obama administration, where people can close down inquiries. And that's what happened here. That actually happened with many of our district attorney offices here, where people could pursue fraud cases. They could do that in Fulton County. Why haven't they? And I want to emphasize Fulton County, because that's the county where you had the video evidence of Ruby Freeman and Shea Freeman, or not Shea Freeman, but her daughter, pulling out those ballots. That's smoking gun evidence of 3 to 4 hours of them running ballots secretly without any observations. So why have
some of them repeatedly? Is that right? What she called Joe Biden ballots?
She called them Joe Biden ballots. We have all of the social media posts saved from her admissions. She thought she was doing the Lord's work in ensuring that the election was stolen. So, you know, it's not just the FBI. It's not just the DOJ. We're talking about district attorneys. And so my best approximation of what happened is that you don't have to have fraud everywhere. You just have to have it through a gamed theory where you've got certain states, certain swing states, and certain counties. And if you can account for a few bad actors in each county, you can do massive damage to our electoral system. And that's what occurred here.
And that's what we're going to pause with and come back to in just a moment with Dr. David Clements on what else was going on after this kind of evidence began to emerge that resulted in an unfair, unfree election in 2020. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and visiting at length, I'm very pleased to say, with Dr. David Clements. Well, a national treasure, I think, is an adequate way to describe him as. He is a man who has devoted much of his life to the rule of law and assuring that it is honored and practiced. And he has been studying closely a momentous instance in which that hasn't happened, apparently, namely the 2020 presidential election. And Dr. Clements, you were talking about the FBI and sort of the law enforcement agencies more generally not stepping up to help, as they are tasked with doing, enforce the law. It seems neither were prosecutors. You were a former DA yourself. They were seemingly AWOL. We've not seen, certainly at least in the period that was relevant to the election, much evidence of state legislators. There were some exceptions, but none that made a difference. How these evidentiary examples of fraud or misconduct or malfeasance were handled. Just quickly, how is it that everybody was, you know, absent without leave, who had a responsibility as well as an opportunity to fix this?
Well, you have to follow the money. And there are many districts, and this might shock your audience, where district attorneys have received large amounts of money from people like George Soros. Bernalillo County here in New Mexico, which is home to Albuquerque, our largest city. Our district attorney received a considerable amount of money from George Soros, and his policies reflect a pro-Black Lives Matter, anti-police policy framework. And so what I suspect, because I've done...
This was money to get them elected to the position or direct contributions?
That's right. And I've checked out the campaign filings and have confirmed that. I'm also finding that in many of these counties where I talk about this game theory, just have to have the right six states or six counties within those states. There is some money coming from folks that do not uphold the rule of law from my standpoint. They basically have tried to foster lawlessness and have criminals out on the street. Now, case in point, in Maricopa County, you've got the district attorney or county attorney. She does prosecution. She's done nothing. In fact, she's aided the Maricopa Board of Supervisors to stop delivery of the machines, the voting machines and the paper ballots for months. Now, the court order from the judge there has said that those subpoenas are legal. But you have to ask yourself, why is it that she is not being responsive to her constituents, but rather assisting the Board of Supervisors in not providing that evidence? So we have to follow the money there. And the reason why I'm saying follow the money, the Gateway Pundit reported just yesterday or the day before that the Maricopa Board of Supervisors received over $3 million from Mark Zuckerberg. And these were, if everyone's looked at the scheme there, wherever Mark Zuckerberg has spent, I think, upwards of $300 million to basically provide a two-tiered system. He'd set up drop boxes in heavily Democrat regions of a county. They're basically creating an uneven playing field between conservatives and progressives. And
unsupervised, insecure drop boxes as well, as I understand it. Is that right?
That broke yesterday, and that was there. So where's the district attorney making sure that the elections haven't been compromised? Well, when you hear that $3 million was received, I'm curious as to how that money's been spent. Did they get a fee? I'm not sure. But right now, that's just breaking. And even to this day, the Board of Supervisors is still trying to block every effort to get a hold of these ballots. They refused an audit within the actual physical location that they're at right now, and they're having to transport them as of this Thursday. They have to be in the Coliseum there in Maricopa County to begin their...
Let's stay with that for just a second, Dr. Clemens, because I Maricopa County is, as you have said, you know, absolutely pivotal in whether we get to the bottom of this problem, not just in that county in Arizona, but across the country, quite possibly. What is the Board of Supervisors of Maricopa County doing to impede the effort to get to the bottom of what happened there? And will they succeed, do you think, in tainting this audit that is now supposed to go forward on the grounds that having moved it from a location they controlled, which was worrying, to one where they didn't have that kind of control in the Coliseum, might break the chain of custody and corrupt the whole effort?
Yes. Well, the chain of custody is important. There's two different aspects to the audit. You've got the physical paper. I feel a little bit better about that because Giovanni Pulitzer's involved, and he's got great technology that can get us answers. The other part is more of a forensic examination of the machines themselves, and that's where I do have serious questions about removing machines from the existing tabulation centers. And there's a technical aspect to that where from a chain of custody, you want to keep things intact. It's like going to a murder scene. You don't let people move the body around and then because you risk not being able to put any evidence into your case. And so you don't want to disturb the scene. And so ideally, you'd want to preserve it. And for the life of me, I don't know why the judge hasn't exercised control, because it's common practice when you have vast amounts of discovery or disclosures that if it's burdensome to transport, you can have them inspected right then and there. And it's not like this building is a bustling center. We're talking about post-pandemic circumstances. These buildings are largely empty. So it begs the question, why are they fighting it? Do I have hope? I've got some hope, but they've already tainted the process by having the clock almost run out. We've got till May 3rd before irregular ballots can be destroyed under the law, because there's only a 6-month time period for irregular ballots. And you look at the legal codes, it doesn't give you a definition, but we've called the county clerks, the secretary of states, and it's this amorphous thing where, well, if there's any question over voter intent, we can destroy those ballots. Well, that's a big problem, because one of the big features of these Dominion machines is that if there's an issue over voter intent, it gets kicked over into this thing called adjudication. And that's where much of the fraud took place, where an independent contractor that works for Dominion or ESNS can basically plug in a vote and provide the intent of the voter for them. And they can do this through all different kinds of ways. They can set a toggle where you're just going to have a large percentage go into adjudication. Or if you've got bad ballots, which we suspect there are, that are misaligned, they will automatically get kicked over into adjudication. And so what we saw on
what could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, it was mass bulk adjudication in many of these counties. And that's a feature of the machine. And just to put this in perspective, Antrim County had a 68% error rate, where 68% of the ballots were kicked into adjudication. That's where we saw the...
That was up in Michigan.
Yeah, in Michigan. And then there's other places where it's 80, 90%, even higher.
So these obviously are red flags, yet we saw, whether it was because of money or perhaps evil, or I think you've actually used the word treason in your earlier presentation at Regent University, we've seen the law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, not doing their job. We've seen prosecutors not doing their job. We've seen state legislators, at least, again, until after the election was finalized, not doing their job. We've seen the, you know, boards of supervisors. We've seen, you know, voting entities in the states. We've seen secretaries of states. We've seen, in some cases, governors. It's unbelievable that there has been such a comprehensive effort made not to evaluate this stuff. Let me ask you quickly, though, sir, before we take a last break. What about the Congress? What about how it comported itself in the post-election period? And the courts, of course, as we were talking about earlier, including the Supreme Court, didn't conduct themselves particularly impressively either. These were the final safety checks, were they not? And they failed to operate as well.
They're supposed to be. And this is where the law just was perverted. Everyone had a plausible reason to punt. And that's what happened from day one. Well, we can't, as a legislature, we can't do anything about it because the Secretary of State's already certified the results on November 20th. Okay. Well, then the people were still upset because they're seeing all this evidence of fraud. Or Governor Ducey certified results in Arizona, I think, in early December. And so everyone was able to put up their hand and say, well, there's nothing I can do now. So either they were lax, they trusted that a court would save us, but everyone was acting in their self-interest and they didn't want to be the reason why potentially millions of Biden votes were disenfranchised. And so they operated under, not under the rule of law, blind justice, but they ruled out of fear. There's a lot of people who thought that if there was an overturning of results, that there would be mass rioting. Well, that's something that people
are not unreasoned fear, I have to say.
Not an unreasoned fear. So that's what we're seeing. That's the climate. But my assessment of the legislature is that it's comprised of cowards, that the judges in these counties are cowards. I'm not pulling any punches. And yes, there was treasonous behavior. There are bad actors like Adrian Fontes, who was the previous recorder in Maricopa County, that I believe needs to go to jail. And there are many others that it's not if, when they are caught. Every lie is going to be revealed here. At some point, these folks are going to be on the wrong side of history. And so as depressing as it might feel like for your listeners, you need to understand that there are many, many people like myself that are pursuing this relentless. We're not going to stop until we shine bright light and expose these traitors for who they are. And so come.
And thank God for that. We have to take a last break. We'll pause just a second here and we'll jump back with Dr. David Clements after this message to talk about what do we do now to ensure that what you just said comes to pass, sir, that we get to the bottom of this, that the truth outs. And hopefully corrective action is taken. Dr. David Clements joins us again on the other side of this break. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. Welcome to the fourth and final installment of this extraordinarily interesting and I think perhaps exceedingly important conversation with Dr. David Clements of New Mexico State University's School of Law, where he teaches business law, but in his spare time, he has devoted his professional skills to getting to the bottom of what happened in the election of 2020, specifically that for the President of the United States. And there's so much else that I'd love to cover with you, Dr. Clements, but I thought we might just focus in this remaining block on what can we do about what you have unearthed and others in the way of election irregularities and fraud and so on. At this late date, there is clearly a lot on the line, and I'm anxious to just find out from you what your thoughts are about, well, as you put it in the Regent program, fraud vitiates all, which I gather is a precept of the law. And talk about that and what that essentially makes possible and well, arguably necessary.
Yes. Well, what I would tell your listeners is this, is that you don't have to be a professor or a trial attorney to fight back. It starts with telling the truth and confronting lies and exposing lies, because the greatest weapon we possess is our numbers. There are 80 plus million of us that know that this election was stolen. So why aren't the 80 million of us engaged in ways where we are trying to change hearts and minds with the truth? And so it starts there. It sounds simple, but you have to take comfort. I mean, how do you respond when James O'Keefe is banned from Twitter for posting accurate video recordings of CNN admitting to propaganda and swaying the election? Well, some people would say, let's despair. The bad guys are winning. I see that as a desperate, desperate move from Twitter, and they're doing this everywhere. And people are awake to that. They are seeing desperate actions to deplatform people. And so I see that as momentum. I see that as actually us being effective when we've got all of these wonderful patriots that are being tireless. And if you look at any objective poll on voter confidence in our election, about 64% of the American people believe that there was interference or substantial interference with our elections. So there's a sleeping giant there. So I'm encouraged by that. And if people want justice to happen sooner, I'd say that it will, but you have to do something. Every one of us must do something each day, whether it's talking to our mother and father, correcting them, educating our kids, not letting a lie go unchallenged.
You have some resources of your own that I would like to make sure people are aware of, and others that you've highly recommended. Could you just give us a quick course on where people can go to equip themselves to do the sorts of things you've just talked about?
Sure. I tried my best to have a evidence compilation at my website, which is theprofessorsrecord.com. The website links at the bottom of the homepage have much of the evidence that I've looked at. There are evidence aggregators like heresTheEvidence.com, electionevidence.com, Peter Navarro's analysis, analysis of 85 plus cases, and it's all there. We've got the 7 hours from the Election Integrity Conference. We've got Mike Lindell's scientific proof, everything that you want to get access. And then I do long form discussions with not just people that have an opinion, but people that have actually worked on the lawsuit. So I've interviewed Joshua Merritt, who's a white hat hacker who had four of his affidavits used in Sidney Powell's filing. So I've interviewed Jovan Hutton Pulitzer, who's doing the actual kinematic scans in Maricopa County. And so, and I actually just yesterday I posted an interview with Joel Altman, who was one of the guys that just outed Eric Coomer, who's one of the vice presidents of Dominion. And we find out that he's got not only ties to Antifa, he was a former skinhead, he's a perpetual habitual liar. And so we're exposing these people. So if you want to have access to those interviews, those long form discussions, I'd invite your audience to go there and really just make up their own mind, because a lot of the sources that I have links to are primary court filings. There's no spin, no editorialization. You can read the affidavits yourself. You can look at public hearings yourself.
Just the facts, ma'am, as they say. Okay, so let's turn to some of the other things that people can do. I mean, obviously supporting you and your vital work is one of them, and helping disseminate it as well. What about Mike Lindell's efforts? Do you believe that he's putting forward sound information that people can rely on, and his movies, for example, should be also virally distributed if possible?
Yes, Mike Lindell. I love Mike Lindell. You take your case as you find it. You've got this jovial MyPillow guy, and a lot of people might scratch their heads. Well, I might want a different advocate asking the questions. And because Mike's kind of got that a Midwestern charm of just, you know, he's a lovable guy, but this is a very sober, sober topic. So in some ways, there's some cognitive dissonance. But what I can tell you about Mike Lindell is he's put his money where his mouth is. He spent millions of dollars to fight for the truth, and the people that he's put on his programs are top notch. There's nothing wrong with the evidence, the expertise. And so I've looked at absolute proof. It's astonishing what he puts out there. I've looked at scientific proof with Dr. Frank's work. Dr. Frank's work has not been challenged. There's some empty rhetoric about saying that it's no good, but they won't actually confront the math and the science behind it because they can't. And now he's got, I think, foreign interference, which is coming out today, which I want to look at. But your listeners should feel confident about that. And the way that I look at it is Mike Lindell, he's the perfect picture of America, a guy that strong businessman, loves his people, loves his company, and he loves truth. And he's doing everything he can under tremendous pressure, threats. I mean, he had basically a security detail to allow him to effectively put these documentaries together because Warren shut him down.
To say nothing of litigation from Dominion and others. And I think, you know, he loves his country too. We've got to say that right up front. And I commend him for his leadership in trying to protect it in this fashion. Let me ask you also about a couple of other of the characters in this drama. Sidney Powell has been similarly vilified and threatened and otherwise defamed. In your piece at Regents, you talked about her extraordinary bio and credentials and really gold-plated, you know, performance as a Department of Justice appellate attorney in some 500 cases. And yet she has been terribly defamed. She has been canceled. What might we do to support her, Dr. Clements?
Well, I think we all need prayers. I think we need to pray for her. She's pulled back the curtain, so to speak, of the deep state, and that makes her so dangerous. She's the best of our profession. Your listeners need to know that. Sidney Powell is the best of our profession. She's everything we want in an advocate, and she's pursuing justice. She's taking the arrows, and she will be vindicated.
Lastly, and very quickly, sir, state legislatures, including Georgia's, are trying to effect reforms to correct some of the problems that were identified by you and others in the 2020 election cycle. At the same time, we're seeing monumental efforts being made to suppress them as well, and to enact through the Congress at the federal level something called HR1. Your quick assessment of those state-level efforts and what is afoot in the federal legislature?
My quick assessment is that beware of smoke and mirrors. These are reforms that we should all be in favor of, but we had great reforms that were already in place that were disregarded under the guise of COVID. And so in some ways, it's like we're really, really going to do a good job in our elections in Georgia. You can trust us this time. But all it takes is an emergency for people to tear up the piece of paper. And that's exactly what happened. So I say beware of smoke and mirrors. And then I'm also a bit distressed over the fact that a lot of the reforms won't catch the culprits with the fraud being caused by these Dominion machines. And so on paper, it looks great. People can say that we've had progress. Raffensperger can pat himself on the back. Governor Kemp can do that. I won't be patting those gentlemen on the back. I think that they know exactly what they're doing, and they're distracting people with easy reforms that really, when push comes to shove, is not going to make Georgia any better. We need to catch the culprits. So I'm not.
And HR1 will be, unfortunately, something that countermands anything good that they do in any event if it is enacted. David Clements, maybe we can return to that in greater length with you on another occasion. I appreciate so much your taking this full hour with us and all of the information that you've imparted and all the work that you've drawn upon in doing so. And I really do hope that you will be one of the people that we can turn to with some regularity, because your work is incalculably important and deeply appreciated, and I want to thank you for it and ask you to continue, as I know you will. Godspeed. And I'm going to ask the rest of you to come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.